Like this podcast? Please rate and review us. Don't want to miss an episode? Please subscribe.
For this Tuesday, May 19th, we welcome you to Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. A key hearing on Capitol Hill as lawmakers and policymakers debate the next steps in helping a U.S. economy that's been in a free fall when it comes to lost jobs and forced business closings. Meanwhile, Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. are expanding their testing for asymptomatic people, being viewed as yet another step toward lifting restrictions in the DMV. The U.S. is now reporting more than 91,000 deaths and just over 1.5 million cases across the country. And another war of words between the House Speaker and the President. The latest on COVID-19 and the story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin on Capitol Hill with the testimony of the Fed Chair Jerome Powell and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. The two testifying before the Senate Banking Committee. We carried it live here on C-SPAN Radio. Among the headlines, the economy is likely to weaken before we see a turnaround. Expect to see more layoffs of state and local government employees, which will impact any recovery. And the unemployment rate could jump to 15% when the next set of numbers released in early June. Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho is the committee chair. And here's one of the exchanges with the two policymakers on which companies have benefited the most from that $2 trillion relief bill that the president signed in late March.
Well, I'll begin with you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, with regard to the municipal facility, the thresholds for cities and counties are established, but they are established at such a level that many of the small cities and counties across the United States cannot apply for individual loans. You have indicated that it would be contemplated that the states be able to apply for loans for these smaller cities and counties. And there's a lot of concern out there about this. I'd like to ask you to clarify that it is intended that these dollars do reach these small cities and counties, and tell us the process by which that can be accomplished.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We, as you've seen, we've been gradually expanding the scope of potential borrowers in this world. And there are 50,000 entities capable of borrowing, so we need to draw some lines to be able to handle this. But in the first instance, we've said that we will always be willing to lend to a state and allow it to with the purpose of downstreaming to counties, cities, other subdivisions of governmental authority within that state. So that's one thing. We also lowered the size of the city. I would tell you, we're continuing to look at ways to accommodate further borrowings, include further borrowers, including perhaps in the case of states with relatively low populations, where the only borrower with access may be the state government itself. We're looking at ways to make sure that in those states that we address the needs of potentially another borrower or two, and that's something we'll be working on going forward.
Well, thank you very much. And Secretary Mnuchin, to you, with regard to the 13-3 facilities, the CARES Act appropriates, if I recall correctly, $500 billion to be utilized through the Exchange Stabilization Fund to help facilitate the implementation of these Section 13-3 facilities by the Federal Reserve. Most of that has not yet played out, correctly? Am I correct?
So there's of the $500 billion, approximately $50 billion was in direct lending programs from the Treasury, and $450 billion was available for the 13-3 facilities. I've allocated about half of that, and let me be clear, I am prepared to allocate the rest of that. The only reason I have not allocated it fully is we are just starting to get these facilities up and running. We want to have a better idea as to which one of the facilities needs more capital, as well as the potential for adding additional facilities. So I expect to allocate all the capital as needed, as was given to us.
From today's Senate Banking Committee and the New York Times writing the following quote, in a joint appearance before lawmakers, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell offering a stark assessment of the fragile state of the economy, warning of more severe job losses in the coming months, but they also offered contrasting views on just how best to help the economy, with the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, suggesting that more fiscal support to states and businesses might be needed to avoid permanent economic damage. Secretary Mnuchin suggesting that without an expeditious reopening, the economy might never fully recover. The full story at nytimes.com. And more from today's hearing with Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. He is the ranking Democrat on that committee.
So how many workers should give their lives to increase our GDP by 0.5%? That you're pushing people back into the workplace. There's been no national program to provide worker safety. The president says reopen slaughterhouses, nothing about slowing the line down, nothing about getting protective equipment. Is how many workers should give their lives to increase the GDP or the Dow Jones by 1,000 points?
You know, workers should give their lives to do that, Mr. Senator, and I think your characterization is unfair. We have provided enormous amounts of equipment. We've worked with the governors. We've done a terrific job of getting...
You know, Mr. Secretary, I'm not going to let you make a political speech about how what a great job. We hear that from the president at his news conferences, when in fact this country... the president is still not led an effort to scale up testing. He's played state after state, state against state. He's played hospital against hospital to get protective equipment. Everybody in the country, your comments notwithstanding, knows that. Chair Powell, you said last week the additional fiscal support could be costly, but worth it if it helps avoid long-term economic damage and leaves us with a stronger economy. So Congress needs to think about more than just the national debt right now. It's less costly to act today to help people than to pay for our failure to act in the future. Is that right, Mr. Chairman?
And if you'd answer quickly, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Well, that is what I said. I said it could be. This is really a question for Congress to weigh. I wanted to call out a risk there, which was the risk of longer-term damage to the economy. And that's what I was doing. And I said we may need to do more, and Congress may as well.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, one brief comment. The administration thinks we should put more workers at risk to juice the stock market. They haven't come up with a basic plan for how to protect workers when they go back to work. When President Trump and Leader McConnell want to give away trillions in tax breaks to billionaires, the price tag didn't matter a couple of years ago when that happened. But we need to spend money now to keep workers safe. In spite of the comments of some in the administration and some in Senate leadership. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That from Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. He is the ranking member on the Senate Banking Committee. And as you can tell, today's hearing was held via video conference. It also comes at a pivotal moment, with Congress and the White House beginning to debate the outlines of what could be potentially another major economic relief bill, potentially injecting trillions of additional taxpayer dollars into the economy. But the plan, which House Democrats passed just last Friday, for the moment remains stalled in the Senate, some calling it dead on arrival. Ben White is the chief economics correspondent for Politico. Late this afternoon, I asked him what headlines came from today's hearing.
Well, I think the headline certainly from the Federal Reserve side is that they would like to see Congress pass some additional stimulus to help this economy. That's been Jay Powell's sort of headline for a while, that he would like more fiscal response from Congress and to see some more money flowing. I think Steve Mnuchin also would like that, but Republicans are not as certain on how they move forward in terms of fiscal response from Congress. So a little bit of a mixed message there between Powell and Mnuchin on whether we get a big fiscal picture, a new package from Congress.
Which really gets to the debate, and you wrote about this earlier at Politico.com, the president versus skeptics on the economy. What will the summer look like? What do you expect?
Well, it's a hard question to answer, Steve, because we don't know the extent to which, even if states say they are reopening and direct people to go about their lives as normal, that they will actually do that. A lot of fear still around the country about engaging in normal economic activities. So I think no matter what happens in terms of, guidelines from state and local governments, it's going to take a while to get this economy moving again, to get people feeling comfortable and going back to work and spending their money. And there are going to be a lot of people who just will not get jobs back right away. So I would not expect to see a, really blockbuster snapback in the economy in the summer into the fall. I think it's going to take us a little while to get back to where we were, and it would be much better if we had a more fulsome health response to this crisis.
And the impact this is having, not only those out of work, but those looking for a job, especially college graduates, the class of 2020.
Yeah, it's really, you know, your heart goes out to folks who are entering the economy at this point, folks coming out of college in 2020. It's going to be difficult. There are not going to be a massive number of available job openings. Companies are going to be slow to hire as they wait to see if demand is there from the consumer, the extent to which business really comes back. So it's not the greatest jobs market to be coming into. It's going to be slow for a little while, and it's going to take the economy a bit to ramp up. And hopefully, God willing, we get up to speed relatively quickly, but it's not the ideal moment right now for folks coming out into the job market.
And from your perspective, Ben White, relatively quickly is a couple of months, half a year, a year. What do you expect?
Yeah, I wish I had the crystal ball for you, Steve, to tell you exactly how quickly we're going to bounce back. I think if things go well and there's not a rebound in the virus in the summer and the fall, we should see the economy start to recover by the end of this year into next. We're going to have a higher unemployment rate for a while. It's going to take a little bit until things really start cooking again. And then if we do get a rebound in the virus, then all bets are off and we could be in a bad spot.
The other big debate, and you wrote about this as well, colleges this fall, with some saying maybe they'll start in August, wrap up before Thanksgiving, have a winter session online, begin sometime in late winter, early spring. Just one of the scenarios that you're hearing from colleges and universities. What are you expecting?
Yeah, there are so many uncertainties around that. I mean, they would certainly love to start opening up in the fall and have everybody come back as normal. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think you'll see a lot of online classes in the fall. People will still be at home. And then assuming we don't get a rebound in the virus, then we start, you know, in the winter and into next year. But it's going to be really tough for colleges to get started as expected this fall, as much as everybody would love it.
Ben White, the chief economic correspondent, his work available at politico.com. Thank you for being with us.
Steve, thank you so much.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing 390 points. The Nasdaq was off by nearly 50 and the S&P down 31. And yet another chain about to shut down. Pier 1 Imports on the verge of closing all of its stores after failing to find a buyer 3 months after initially filing for bankruptcy. But other retailers, including Walmart and Home Depot, reporting a huge increase in quarterly sales. In fact, Walmart says online sales surging this last quarter by 74%. Now to the ongoing debate over hydroxychloroquine, with news yesterday that the president has been taking the drug for the past week and a half. A number of leading health experts warning there is no evidence this drug used to treat malaria can fight coronavirus. Also advising people that a serious side effect could include heart problems. The president traveling to Capitol Hill today, meeting with Senate Republicans at their weekly luncheon, and CNN's Manu Raju with this question.
The FDA warned that hydroxychloroquine could cause serious side effects, especially health with the heart. Why is it okay for you to promote the use of this drug when you're not a doctor and health experts are working?
Well, I've worked with doctors, and if you look at the one survey, the only bad survey, they were giving it to people that were in very bad shape. They were very old, almost dead. It was a Trump enemy statement. Now, if you look at some of the reports that came out from Italy, that came out from France, that came out from other, a lot of our frontline workers take it because it possibly, and I think it does, but, you know, people are going to have to make up their own mind. Plus, it doesn't hurt people. It's been out on the market for 60 or 65 years for malaria, lupus, and other things. I think it gives you an additional level of safety, but you can ask many doctors are in favor of it. Many frontline workers won't go there unless they have the hydroxy. And so, again, this is an individual decision to make, but it's had a great reputation. And if it was somebody else other than me, people would say, gee, isn't that smart? But we are working on a lot of other things. We have, I'll tell you what, the great medical companies that we have, if you look at what they're doing therapeutically, cure-wise, and the vaccine itself, and the vaccine, I think, is less important than some of the things they're working on. They're working on a cure, and we have more than one doing it and very advanced. They're working on therapeutics. And they're working on vaccines. There's been tremendous progress.
Made. From Capitol Hill, where the president met with Senate Republicans, and by the way, Politico's playbook, reporting that today's lunch was served buffet style, advising senators to arrive before noon to get the buffet. That's another health warning, with the CDC advising Americans to avoid buffets and salad bars during this pandemic. On CNN last night, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi taking another swipe at the president.
He's our president, and I would rather he not be taking something that has not been approved by the scientist, especially in his age group and in his, shall we say, weight group, what is morbidly obese, they say. So I think it's not a good idea.
Well, overnight, Twitter reporting that President Plump and Trump morbidly obese had been trending. And earlier this month, Speaker Pelosi making these remarks about the president in a C-SPAN interview.
Is the president part of these discussions, these negotiations?
I don't have any idea what the president does.
He said that the House was on vacation.
But you know what? Don't waste your time or mine on what he says, okay? We're trying to get a job done for the American people in a way that brings people together. We certainly have our differences of opinion. We have a strong agreement that we have a responsibility to meet the needs of the American people.
Those recent comments by Speaker Pelosi in a C-SPAN interview, it's clear the Speaker and the President are not talking to each other. Here's the President earlier today on Capitol Hill.
These people are sick. Pelosi is a sick woman. She's got a lot of problems, a lot of mental problems. We're dealing with people that have to get their act together for the good of the country. Okay, thank you very much.
And that from the president on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. By the way, Vice President Mike Pence saying that he is not taking hydroxychloroquine. Pence telling Fox News that his physician has not recommended it, although if the doctor did, he would not hesitate to use the drug. Meanwhile, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell today defending the president, saying he, in fact, does have the power to fire inspectors general amid the scrutiny over his decision to oust the State Department watchdog. The president announcing late Friday evening that he was firing Steve Linnick, the fourth inspector general the president has removed in the last couple of months. The Kentucky Republican speaking to reporters after the Senate party lunch.
On Friday night, the president fired another inspector general. He dismissed several of them in the last month. Do you have any concerns at all by the president getting rid of these watchdogs?
Yeah, look, he is certainly within his authority. He gets to hire and fire under the Constitution all people in the executive branch, and that's a good question to address to the administration.
Does he need to provide a more detailed rationale for this?
As I said, he has the full authority to hire and fire under the Constitution anybody in the executive branch. They all serve at the pleasure.
Did that come up in the lunch, the firings of the IGs?
I'm sorry?
Did it come up in the lunch? Did he talk about the firings of the IGs?
We talked about a whole variety of different things. All of which are important in terms of moving forward, but mainly we focused on the pandemic and the way forward for the country. As Senator Young pointed out, I mean, there's only one way out of this dilemma. America has to come to grow again, to open up again, and I'm pleased that that's beginning to happen in my state and other states. People are anxious to get out, bearing in mind the precautions that we've been advised to take by Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and others who know what they're talking about.
The president appealed directly to you to talk more about the origins of the Russia investigation and the Flynn case. And then this morning on the floor, you talked directly about that. Did he talk to you between that time period about this?
Well, I think, you know, Chairman Graham is going to have ball control on reviewing those events. He can speak for himself, but he has a pretty expansive plan to look into all of that. Certainly the public is entitled to have the answers, and I'm confident Senator Lindsey Graham is going to make that possible.
That from the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. And on Twitter, the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, saying the president came to the Republican caucus lunch, which was a buffet. They had a giant pep rally and got all fired up to do nothing on the COVID-19 crisis. And then on the Senate floor, the New York Democrat again taking aim at his GOP colleagues.
Leader McConnell, stop listening to President Trump and his wild theories and listen to the American people. We need action. We need action now. Every day, every week, and now almost every month, we wait. The recession gets deeper and worse. More people are unemployed. More people lose their jobs. More small businesses are in jeopardy. And we're talking about some wild theory because President Trump 2 days demanded it, when everyone knows the president's penchant for truth is at a bare minimum, as exemplified by his hydroxychloroquine comments last night. Wow. This is unbelievable. In the midst of historic unemployment and economic and health tragedy, Senate Republicans are using their majority to simply block and tackle for the president's reelection campaign. Senate Republicans are using their majority not to tackle the COVID crisis, but to block and tackle for the president's reelection campaign. In the midst of a public health crisis, Senate Republicans are diving headfirst into the muck to smear the family of the president's political opponent. It's such a gross misuse of the power of the majority. We were sent here to do the nation's business. At the moment, that means helping our constituents through a time of immense challenge and large hardship. But Senate Republicans are using their committees to hold fishing expeditions dictated by the president's Twitter feed, which even his supporters don't usually believe. If anyone doubts this is about politics, if this is about Senate Republicans doing the bidding of President Trump's personal political agenda, just remember what House Minority Leader McCarthy said before the last presidential election. Leader McCarthy went on Fox News and bragged the Republicans put together a Benghazi select committee to bring Hillary Clinton's poll numbers down. And now Senate Republicans are using the same playbook to smear President Trump's political opponents once again. It will not work. The American people know there's a crisis. They know that the Republicans are doing nothing right now.
We carry the Senate live on C-SPAN 2. That earlier today, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York. Now more than 40,000 National Guard members currently helping states test residents for the coronavirus and trace the spread of the infection will face what the administration is calling a hard stop on their deployments on June 24th. Now that date is significant because it is just one day shy of many members becoming eligible for key federal benefits. A number of reports that FEMA outlining the Trump administration plans during an interagency call earlier this month. The official, who was not named, acknowledged that the June 24th deadline means that thousands of members of those first deployed back in late March will find themselves with only 89 days of duty credit, one short of the 90-day threshold qualifying for early retirement, education benefits under the post-9/11 GI Bill. Now to the states, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo telling reporters today that his state's coronavirus outbreak has slowed to levels not seen since the beginning of the pandemic. The number of coronavirus deaths topping 105 on Monday, which is about the same number as lives lost on March the 26th. And at one point, New York's death toll was averaging 800 per day. From Albany, Governor Cuomo.
When does government really become important? Probably almost not in my lifetime. You know, when has it been vital? It's vital at the time of war, crisis, real national crisis. But that's the only time it's really vital, where you don't have a choice but to deal with and rely on government. Well, government is now important again in a way it hasn't been in my lifetime. It matters what government does. Government has made the difference between life and death here, right? Because government is part of social action. And the people who saved lives in this are New Yorkers for doing the right thing. But government was part of that, right? It helps organize. Today, government's going to be held to a different standard, and it has to be fundamentally different. It has to be smarter than it was. It matters now what happens. You have to know what you're doing now. Not just look like you know what you're doing. Not just sound like you know what you're doing. You have to be smart. You're not going to tweet your way through this. You have to be smart. You have to be competent at what you do. There's something called government. And you either know how to do it or you don't know how to do it. You know, for many years, anyone can be in government, you know. I don't know. Can anyone be a nurse? Oh, no, you have to know what you're talking about. Can anyone be a doctor? No, you have to know what you're talking about. Can anyone be a lawyer? No, you have to know what you're talking about. Can anyone be a plumber? No, you have to know what you're talking about. Can anyone run government? Oh, yeah, anybody can run government. The less you know, the better. Well, that wasn't true. You have to be competent. And it has to be beyond politics. This is not about an ongoing campaign. You're now a government official. You represent everyone. Forget the politics. Represent people. And it doesn't matter, Republican, Democrat. That's all garbage now. I'm the governor of New York. All New Yorkers. I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, atheist. I don't care if you vote. I don't care if you don't vote. That's your business. I represent you. You pay me to represent you. That's how I see it. And government has to be fair, and it has to be effective. That's where we all are now. And that's where we've been in New York.
The Daily Briefing with Governor Andrew Cuomo, all of them available on our website at cspan.org/coronavirus. Meanwhile, the state of Ohio is transitioning from orders to strong recommendations. That announcement in Columbus from Governor Mike DeWine. With the exceptions of mandates for some businesses, the state is now lifting most orders, including travel restrictions.
Good afternoon, Governor. Randy Ludlow with the Columbus Dispatch. Since apparently the order will not today, or advisory or whatever you want to call it, will not be available today in writing, and a lot of confusion remains, at least as evidenced by readers and my editors, to clarify a couple of things. Coronavirus precautions placed on businesses previously remain in place, correct?
Coronavirus orders remain, in fact, on business.
Social distancing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And the restriction on mass gathering still applies to individuals, correct?
Yes, with the exception of anything that has been carved out.
Right, that was permitted previously.
And so, you know, you may have something as we move forward. And we're going to continue to look at that particular number and see what is, you know, is the right number. But for now, that number remains.
So I cannot have a party with 500 of my closest friends at my house on Memorial Day.
Are you buying? We could change the order. No?
Governor, I remind you
of the newspaper
report.
It's okay. No, the answer is no. You can't do it.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's from Governor DeWine, again advising that while restrictions are being lifted, he is urging residents to abide by common sense health and safety guidelines across Ohio. In other news on this Tuesday, Michael Flynn's lawyer filing an emergency petition today asking a federal appeals court to force a judge to dismiss the criminal charges against the former national security advisor. Flynn's legal team is asking the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to intervene as a judge delays consideration of that Justice Department decision to drop the charges. Judge Emmett Sullivan, who, by the way, is a Clinton appointed to the federal district court, has asked a former judge to investigate the moves by the Justice Department. It has been a bipartisan White House tradition for decades. The former president returning to the White House, where the current occupant of the White House announcing the official hanging of a presidential portrait. In fact, it dates back to 1980 when then-President Jimmy Carter honoring the man he defeated 4 years earlier, Gerald Ford. But it is now the latest casualty in this political divide. We'll talk to NBC News White House correspondent Carol Lee in just a moment. She broke the story this morning. But first, two moments with four presidents, beginning with President Clinton.
I managed to get a glimpse of these portraits, and I must admit that I think the artist did a wonderful job, and we're all in his debt. But I also want to say, President Bush, if I looked half as good as you do when I leave office, I'll be a happy man.
Michelle and I are grateful to the entire Bush family for their guidance and their example during our own transition. George, I will always remember the gathering you hosted for all the living former presidents before I took office, your kind words of encouragement.
Those two moments from the White House with former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, with George H.W. Bush, known as 41, and George W. Bush, known as 43. Carol Lee of NBC News writing that the White House portrait ceremony may be the latest casualty of the political divide. The White House correspondent is joining us on the phone. What have you learned?
Well, it's been a tradition for decades now, going back to when President Carter hosted President Ford at the White House in the East Room. And every president except Carter didn't have his own ceremony for a portrait unveiling. But every other president has since then. And what we've learned is that President Obama and President Trump will not be taking part in this sort of rite of passage for a former president. And the reason being is kind of obvious, because they really have had a very acrimonious relationship since President Trump came into office, and that's escalated significantly in the last few weeks. What I'm told is that the Obamas went through the usual process, which is that toward the end of an administration or right after a president leaves office, they select an artist. They work with the White House Historical Association. The White House Historical Association creates a contract. Obviously, it's all kept secret who the artist is, what the paintings look like, and then usually by the final year of their president's successor being in office, the painting is ready. They invite family, friends, former staff to the East Room and have a ceremony where it's really one of the more lighthearted kind of moments in the presidency, where the institution of the presidency kind of transcends the political battles that we tend to see day to day. And there are jokes and warm things said about each other. And it's basically a pause in the back and forth that tend to see between presidents of different parties, or some of them have campaigned against each other, and that's just not going to happen this time.
And of course, over the years, you look back at former presidents Ford and Carter, who after their White House years became very close friends.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Bill Clinton would often travel to Kennebunkport to be with George H.W. Bush. We certainly know that Michelle Obama and George W. Bush are close friends, passing candy to each other when they're at public events. Mm-hmm. We sat down, though, with President Trump last July, and he had said since he's been in the White House, not once has he reached out to a former president.
Yes, and President Trump just doesn't see the office that way. He doesn't see his predecessors that way. He's said that he doesn't really think about, who's come before him and kind of what that means. He doesn't ruminate about that, as opposed to Bill Clinton, who at his portrait unveiling said that he used to walk the halls and look at these portraits, and some of them are so famous to all of us growing up as kids. It's kind of the first introduction that we got to presidents in our history. Bill Clinton really took that in, and President Trump just doesn't see it like that. And he's been very combative with the successor, the predecessors of his that are currently living. Even George W. Bush, he recently took a swipe at him, and obviously he and President Obama are very much not getting along these days, to put it mildly.
And Carol Lee, based on your reporting, which is available online at NBCNews.com, it seems as if the Obamas don't really care, that they're happy to wait.
Happy to wait, yep. And I think actually prefer to wait. In talking with people for this story, it was clear that President Obama and presumably also the First Lady just don't have an interest in doing this while Trump is in office. And frankly, it's hard as a reporter, who I was there when President Obama hosted President Bush for his, and there were jokes, and Bush made this crack about, because Obama has campaigned against him pretty intensely in 2008, that's how he got to the White House, particularly against the Iraq War, and President Bush joked that now Obama could wander the halls of the White House and look at his portrait and wonder what would George do. And it's just hard to imagine President Trump and President Obama sharing a moment like that, given all of the acrimony that is between the two of them.
Carol Lee, who covers the White House, her work available at NBC News and MSNBC. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Also today here in Washington at NASA headquarters, Vice President Mike Pence, who heads up the Space Council, hosting a preview of the U.S. program that will launch next week, returning American astronauts into space.
We are 1 week and 1 day away from when America will return American astronauts on American rockets from American soil to space. And it's an extraordinarily exciting time in the life of this program, and I know I speak on behalf of the President of the United States when I express my appreciation, Jim, to you, to the entire NASA team, my profound and humble admiration for the astronauts that we'll be speaking to in just a few moments, who will be carrying American leadership back into space from American soil next week, and I know I speak for the President when I say how grateful we are for the long hours of work represented by the members of this administration, of so many critical agencies, that has really put into practice President Trump's vision for renewed American leadership in space.
That from the Vice President earlier today. The NASA astronauts, by the way, will fly on SpaceX's Crew Dragon spacecraft, lifting off on a Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral, Florida, next week. Well, Annie Glenn, the widow of space pioneer and astronaut and U.S. Senator John Glenn, she passed away earlier today at the age of 100. Her death, the result of complications from COVID-19, she was at a nursing home facility near St. Paul, Minnesota. At the time of John Glenn's death back in 2016, the two had been married for 73 years. She'd moved to Minnesota to be closer to her daughter. Annie Glenn was thrust into the spotlight back in 1962 when her husband became the first American to orbit Earth. She often shied away from the media attention because she had a stuttering issue. But in 1984, when Senator Glenn was running for the Democratic presidential nomination, C-SPAN's Carrie Collins speaking to Annie Glenn.
Speaking of home, what's the whole campaign done for your family life in general? Has it brought you closer together?
Not closer together. John and I have known each other since we were 2 years old.
We were in love
when we were in the eighth grade.
Oh, and that's incredible.
And in April, we will celebrate our 41 wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you very, very much. I think it's sort of special. And John and I and our children have always been very, very close. So it really hasn't brought us closer together because we were close.
Mm-hmm. An American love story from a 1984 C-SPAN interview. Annie Glenn, the wife of the late Senator John Glenn. She died today as a result of coronavirus. Annie Glenn was 100 years old. By the way, this program, Washington Today, is also available as a podcast. You can find it by searching Washington Today wherever you get your podcasts, or better yet, go to our website, cspan.org/podcasts. For this Tuesday, May 19th, I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening. On C-SPAN's The Weekly, as the presumptive Democratic nominee, Joe Biden is in the process of selecting his running mate. We know it will be a woman. The question remains, who? We talked to former Vice President Walter Mondale, who is the last Democratic nominee back in 1984 to select a female running mate, then Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. He is also credited with redefining the role of the vice presidency during his 4 years in the Carter administration.
I think that I helped talk Carter into it, but I think Carter was half persuaded to do it when we started talking, because he knew that the vice presidency had been a totally underused and wasted office.
Former vice president and 1984 Democratic presidential nominee Walter Mondale.
on C-SPAN's The Weekly. It's available at cspan.org/podcasts. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @CSPAN Radio.